From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, filling in for Terry Gross. The book The English Patient, about four people stranded in an Italian villa after World War II, has been made into a new film. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we'll hear from Michael Ondaatje, who wrote the prize-winning novel, and critic John Powers will review the film. Also, opera's crossover star Dawn Upshaw, the acclaimed soprano, has just released a collection of songs of Rodgers and Hart. Also, director Philip Haas. His film Angels and Insects, based on the A.S. Byatt novella, has come out on video. We'll hear what it's like directing ants, moths, and butterflies along with the actors. And book critic Maureen Cargan reflects on Shakespeare's reemergence in Hollywood. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
Fresh Air support comes from Morrow, publisher of the new cookbook, Baking with Julia. Savor the joys of baking with America's best bakers, based on the PBS series hosted by Julia Child. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, sitting in for Terry Gross. The long-awaited film, The English Patient, based on Michael Ondaatje's award-winning novel, opens today in New York and Los Angeles. It's the story of four survivors of World War II. A nurse, a professional thief-turned-spy, an East Indian soldier who defuses bombs, and an Englishman who's dying from burns he received in an airplane crash. The film stars Ralph Fiennes and Kristin Scott Thomas. Before we hear from Michael Ondaatje from a 1994 interview, we have a review of The English Patient from our film critic, John Powers.
When people complain that Hollywood isn't what it used to be, what they usually mean is that they want movies they can get lost in. Movies with sweep and passion and grandeur. This wish largely comes true in The English Patient, an engrossing 2-hour and 40-minute epic based on the acclaimed novel by Michael Ondaatje. The time is the end of World War II. The scene is a ruined Tuscan monastery which houses a ragtag collection of survivors. There's Caravaggio, played by Willem Dafoe, a thumbless rogue who's seeking some mysterious revenge. There's Kip, a Sikh bomb disposal expert who's defusing mines in the area. And there's a French-Canadian nurse, Hannah, played by Juliette Binoche, who believes that anyone she grows close to will die. Hannah's looking after a hideously burned man, played by Ralph Fiennes, who claims to be suffering from amnesia. But as Hannah reads to this man, who's known simply as the English Patient, his mind wanders back to pre-war days, when he and his colleagues were making maps of the uncharted North African desert. There, under his real name of Count Laszlo de Almassy, he had a love affair with a married woman, Catherine Clifton, an affair whose ironic trajectory has led him to this bed in Tuscany, where he attempts to make sense of his life. The movie was written and directed by the English filmmaker Anthony Minghella, whose first film, Truly Madly Deeply, showed him to be a pure-blooded romantic. In literalizing Ondaatje's highly poetic novel for the screen, he's put most of his energy into capturing the adulterous affair. As the story leapfrogs between different times and places, we watch Almassy go from being a cold, abrupt, fact-driven explorer to a lover obsessed with another man's wife. We understand his obsession because Catherine's marvelously played by Kristin Scott Thomas, probably the most intelligent-seeming actress in movies today. Scott Thomas has spent much of her career playing second fiddle. She's the woman Hugh Grant didn't want in Four Weddings and a Funeral. But in this, her first major starring role, she blossoms. She holds her own with the brilliant Fiennes, whose handsomeness always bears the mark of some lacerating psychic wound. Their scenes together have a fierce erotic friction, even when Catherine tells Almassy she wants to end their affair.
Say goodbye here.
I'm not agreeing. Don't think I'm agreeing, because I'm not.
Any minute now he'll find out. We'll barge into someone. It will kill him.
Don't go over it again, please. Catherine. I just want you to know I'm not missing you yet.
You will. You will.
He does. But if The English Patient does a superb job of catching us up in its love story, It's less successful in conveying the epic splendor of a tale that moves between the desert, Cairo, and Italy. Minghella began as a playwright, and he often directs like someone who's happiest when dealing with actors. Although the movie's handsomely shot by John Seale, it never rises to the visual magnificence of epics like Lawrence of Arabia, or dazzling tales of romantic obsession like Alfred Hitchcock's recently reissued Vertigo. The Tuscan monastery is pretty, but it never becomes the enchanted spot it ought to be. Yet if The English Patient lacks the breathtaking magic of the very best filmmaking, it's still charged with a swoony sense of romantic longing that makes its 160 minutes fly by. And it's filled with marvelous scenes, like Kip showing Hannah frescoes in a church by hoisting her on a rope, or Catherine and Al Massey making furtive, frenzied love at a colonial Christmas party as Silent Night plays in the background. In moments like these, The English Patient is every bit as thrilling as the classic movies of the past, and it reminds you that there are some dreams so powerfully ardent that they cry out to be shown on a big screen.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Writer Michael Ondaatje was born in Sri Lanka, went to boarding school in England, and settled in Canada when he was 20. Like Ondaatje himself, his writing is a blend of many cultural influences. He's been writing poetry and novels for more than 25 years, and his books include a memoir about his extended family in Sri Lanka called Running in the Family. I spoke with Michael Ondaatje about his novel The English Patient in 1994, and we began with a reading from the opening page of the book.
Every 4 days she washes his black body, beginning at the destroyed feet. She wets a washcloth and, holding it above his ankles, squeezes the water onto him, looking up as he murmurs, seeing his smile. Above the shins, the burns are worst, beyond purple. Bone. She has nursed him for months, and she knows the body well, the penis sleeping like a seahorse, the thin, tight hips. Hip bones of Christ, she thinks. He is her despairing saint. He lies flat on his back, no pillow, looking up at the foliage painted onto the ceiling, its canopy of branches, and above that, blue sky. She pours calamine in stripes across his chest where he is less burned, where she can touch him. She loves the hollow below the lowest rib, its cliff of skin. Reaching his shoulders, she blows cool air onto his neck, and he mutters, "What?" she asks, coming out of her concentration. He turns his dark face with its gray eyes towards her. She puts a hand into her pocket. She unskins the plum with her teeth, withdraws the stone, and passes the flesh of the fruit into his mouth. He whispers again, dragging the listening heart of the young nurse beside him to wherever his mind is, into that well of memory he kept plunging into during those months before he died.
That's Michael Ondaatje reading from the very beginning of The English Patient. When I first read that, I thought this was a scene about lovers. It was a description of lovers, mm-hmm. not a description of a nurse and her patient.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think I didn't know at that point. I mean, I knew when I went back to rewrite it, and I wanted to keep a kind of certain possibility of that there. I mean, I think any kind of intimacy between four people, you know, different variations of between those four people, is a kind of love, you know, and I think that's what happens in this book. Even that not involved sexually, there's a kind of tremendous intimacy that happens with these four people. So the kind of physical closeness of that time and place makes it a possibility, certainly.
Well, you seem to have a kind of a sensitivity to the senses. There's a scene a couple pages later on where Hannah is told about the smell of a dog's paw, something that really resonated with me. But you seem to be very keyed into the senses.
Well, I think as a writer, writers want to get, at least I want to get as close as possible to the people I'm writing about. If I'm going to spend, you know, 4 or 5 years on a book with these people, that's my closest company in a way. And it really takes about a year to kind of finally kind of cut out the small talk and get close to these people. And really the first year kind of gets dumped usually. So there is a kind of, hopefully, a great closeness to some noise they hear in the distance, mm-hmm. or what they're feeling in their fingertips.
Well, these four characters come together because of the war. It's the war that brings them together. Do you identify with their displacement because of the fact that you grew up in Sri Lanka and you lived in England, now live in Canada?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I think all four of them, whether they're male or female or, you know, or from whatever part of the world they're from, I have to identify with them. I think I wasn't really conscious of them all being, as one of them says, international bastards, you know, but that's what happens in this book. They're all people who are plucked out of Toronto and left in Venice, or plucked out of India and put into London or something like that. So, but I think that's the story of our time. That's, you know, I mean, you can pick up any group of people in a living room today and 8 out of 10 of them don't come from that area or part of town.
You were born in Sri Lanka in the 1940s, and as I read about your life and your family, came from a rather eccentric, theatrical kind of family. Describe them for us.
Well, it's difficult to describe your mom and dad as eccentrics, really, but, you know, I think when I began that book, I knew very little about my family. I left Sri Lanka at the age of 11. So when I went back in my late 20s, I thought I might try and write a book about my family and where I came from, and discovered this incredible world of really kind of the jazz age, really, in the tropics. You know, they were all extreme. They didn't seem to have too much of a conscience or, you know, some kind of governor in them. So it was a very excessive life of, you know, drinking and partying and dancing and general bad behavior.
And this is the book that you wrote back in 1982 called Running in the Family.
Right. Right. And it's a book that I thought I was doing just for myself, you know, and it was my little family drama. And I didn't think, in fact, I would even get it published. But it was one of the books that really caught on of mine that, you know, so I mean, I get letters from Utah or something like that, people saying this is just like my family, or someone from New Zealand saying the same thing. It's very odd how if you write about your own place and time and your own local group of people, you know, again, a kind of intimacy, perhaps. You know, it kind of suddenly kind of connects with someone at the other end of the world.
Your family was wealthy for a time.
They were briefly wealthy. They had no money, then they got money and they spent it all and wasted it, and then we were back to square one.
So when you were little, were they wealthy or in between
wealth? I think I was on the kind of point when they were falling off the precipice, really.
So what kind of a house? What kind of a did your family have servants?
Yeah, but I mean, most families, you know, had servants. It's quite a kind of normal thing, I think. Mm-hmm. I think what I did have in Sri Lanka was a kind of extended family. You know, my parents broke up, which was no surprise, but it was a kind of buffer zone that, you know, because you had so many uncles and aunts, you always wanted to stay with them, or, you know, so the family. The nuclear family in Sri Lanka is not four people, two parents and two kids. It's about 17 people. So in some senses, it protects you as a child anyway.
Would you say you had a happy childhood?
I had a very happy childhood, actually. I think my older brother and older sisters did not. I think they were a bit... I was kind of blithely kind of, you know, being a small child at the time.
Your father was an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of a drinker was he? Do you remember?
Well, he was a kind of binge drinker, I think. You know, I mean, he didn't drink for months, and then he'd start drinking, and then he'd kind of, you know, be drinking for several days nonstop, and then kind of collapse, then be back to the genial, loving father. So it was that kind of thing that was happening. So that makes you pretty tense, I think, you know, for many years afterwards. Mm.
Would his personality really change then from when he started to drink?
Yeah, I mean, he was, you know, you really couldn't really communicate with him very much. He was in his own planet then. But, you know, for most of the time, like 90% of the time, he was a great person, a wonderful person.
You described the extended family that you had in Sri Lanka. When your parents divorced, what effect did it have on you and your siblings? Did you feel the family break apart, or were there enough other members
well,
to catch everybody?
Again, there were the other members around. You know, I mean, I think it was tough, sort of on the older members of the family. But I, you know, I mean, I carried on quite happily, you know, from household to household. So it was easier being there. I wasn't in a kind of, you know, apartment in downtown New York or something.
Your brother Christopher also wrote about
your
life, all of your life's lives in Sri Lanka. And he, writing about your book about the family, Running in the Family, he wrote that book is a love letter to the father he, meaning you, never knew, a large and glamorous man away in the distance. But I had been deeply involved with the same man and had to grapple with his demons, which never seemed either romantic or amusing. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting reading that to see how two brothers in the same family can have two very different childhoods.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, my two sisters also have very differing points of view. You know, it's difficult. See, I think what happened was that Christopher, who's about 10 years older than I am, knew my father at a time when, if anything, he was probably more dangerous than tragic. You know, I mean, and then he went to England, and then, in fact, I probably knew him as every brother claims to be the right person. But so I knew him 10 years later when he was a much sadder person, and it seemed much more tragic to me than to Christopher, you know.
Michael Ondaatje's novel, The English Patient, has just been made into a movie. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to novelist Michael Ondaatje. His book, The English Patient, is now a movie.
You moved to England then when you were about 10 years old. Your mother had already moved there, and then you moved to live with her. What was it like for you to make that transition from Sri Lanka to England?
Well, it should have been hell, you know, and I think it was hell in a way, because, I mean, here I was going from a country where I hadn't worn socks or long trousers, to have to wear both of those things and a tie and a stiff collar and a cap and jacket. And
sounds very confining.
Very confining. And it wasn't so much the confinement, it was a complete different set of rules one had to learn about how to behave, you know. It's like, so it was quite shocking. In order to kind of survive that, I had to kind of forget the past. You know, it was one of those things where I had to kind of forget that I was from Sri Lanka and forget, you know, what it was like to eat, you know, string hoppers in the morning or something like that instead of poached eggs. So I think, in a way, Running the Family was a book I wrote as a result of having kind of almost lost that whole childhood time, you know, for almost 20 years.
You moved to Canada, where your brother, your older brother Christopher, was living when you were about 20. What did Canada offer to you?
Canada offered me, I mean, I didn't know at the time when I moved, but it offered me everything. You know, it was wonderful. I think when I left school, whatever it was, 18 or 19 or something like that, in England, I had no idea what I was going to do, like every 9-year-old. And I hadn't really had a chance to kind of... I had a great passion for reading novels and reading English and writing essays and poetry and stuff like that, but it had just been in the kind of, you know, in the classroom. And when I went to university in Canada, I was very lucky to find a great teacher who kind of inspired the whole class. You know, everyone wanted to be Robert Browning. Everyone wanted to write poetry, essentially. And so I began to write poetry. I don't think I would have had that nerve if I'd stayed in England. You know, I think the new world, it really was a new world. You could begin and become a mountain climber or champion cyclist or poet even. You know.
Did you surprise yourself with the fact that you could write?
I don't know. I suppose I did. I mean, I had no idea that people would be interested in this stuff, you know. I suddenly surprised my family. My mother was completely shocked. She kind of couldn't believe it. I mean, she, in fact, if anyone was a great inspirer, she was. Because I think what she did, I mean, she had a very rough life after her divorce, and she brought up the kids in London and, you know, had a very tough job. But she would always take us to theatres. You know, I mean, the second night I arrived in England, I was taken to a West End play. Mm. And, you know, whenever she could grab tickets from someone, she'd take us to the theatre, or she'd read books. And so that the fact of literature being a right and being not a kind of a waste of time, I mean, that sense was, I think, the most important thing I got from my parents, in a way.
You won the Booker Prize for The English Patient, and this is, of course, a very prestigious prize. Does that make you a celebrity in Canada?
Yeah, it did. It does, I guess. It's in a way, it's made me a bit more public than I probably want to be. But, you know, I guess that's, you had to put, you know, give up that to a certain extent. But, you know, I mean, one can also remain pretty private.
But if you're now famous, do people want you to say things, to make pronouncements about events?
That does happen, you know, and you always want, they be wanting to kind of do, you know, various things. And some of which you are quite happy to do. But, you know, in a way, it's you're also kind of worrying about the next thing, so... You know, the thing is, you want to become go back to being a human being.
Michael Ondaatje's novel, The English Patient, has just been reissued in paperback. The film based on The English Patient opens today in New York and Los Angeles. I'm Marty Moscoane, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, what it's like directing ants, moths, and other creatures in the film Angels and Insects. We'll hear from director Philip Haas. And there are three new Shakespeare movies out this season. Maureen Corrigan ponders what that says about the prolific writer. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, in for Terry Gross. We have a special program this Monday on Fresh Air, an interview and concert with soprano Dawn Upshaw. She's an acclaimed opera singer who's known as the Undiva and the Diva Next Door because of her approachable, unassuming style. She has a new recording, Dawn Upshaw Sings Rodgers and Hart. On Monday's concert, she'll feature Rodgers and Hart, accompanied by pianist Fred Hirsch and a 15-piece ensemble, led by Broadway conductor Eric Stern. Here's an excerpt from an interview that Dawn Upshaw recorded with Terry Gross in 1994. They began with the song, That's Him.
You know the way you feel when there is autumn in the air. That's him. That's him. The way you feel when Antoine has finished with your hair. That's him. That's him. You know the way you feel when you smell bread baking. The way you feel when suddenly a tooth stops aching. Wonderful world, wonderful you. That's him. That's him. He is as simple as a swim in summer.
Dawn Upshaw, do you think you use your voice differently when you're singing Broadway songs and when you're singing opera? Is there a different range, for instance, that you're in?
Oh, definitely. A much different vocal range. Just in terms of the lower, it's a much lower range. I'm using more of my middle and lower notes than I do in opera and other classical music. But I really like to think that in terms of producing the sound, I'm not doing much differently. I think what is the primary difference is the way I use words and perhaps use the consonants and the vowels in order to sound as natural as possible. Now, hearing myself say that, I think, geez, I should do that all the time, whether I'm singing classical music or music theater. But anyway, I felt like everything needed to be very accessible, the diction especially.
So what's the difference between the way you pronounce consonants and vowels in opera and the way you do with music theater?
I guess I give myself a little bit more liberty in the music theater to express and maybe spend a little bit more time on consonants, for instance. It becomes more important, depending on what style you're singing in, but say Mozart, to sing more legato, and so much of the way the music is written and a phrase is turned depends on singing on vowel longer than necessarily, you know, playing with consonants.
Yeah, I think a lot of classical singers are appalled at the way pop singers sing the consonants. Mm-hmm. I mean, consonants are supposed to just end the vowel, right?
Well, kind of except I find that it's the consonants that really make a singer, you know, individual from another singer, because you can be so expressive with a consonant. I find that it's much more difficult to be expressive with a vowel, you know.
Is there any way you could demonstrate for us what you mean?
Sure. One of the songs, That's Him, I'm trying to say, you know the way you feel when there is autumn in the air. That's him. That's him. And when I sing That's Him, I think that the M can show everybody how much I love him. I can enjoy, almost like I'm eating a delicious fruit. I can enjoy that M. And what I might do if it were Mozart, although I'm not certain about this, but I think, you know, that I might dwell more on the vowel and less on the M.
And how would that sound?
And that's him. That's him. You know.
Right. Something. Right.
Much less interesting, isn't it?
I know there was a time when you wanted to sing jingles.
<'Cause>, yes.
Why, because you can make a living simply that way?
Yes, it seemed pretty good to me. I was working as a secretary in a studio where they recorded jingles one summer between years in high school. And these singers would come in. I mean, they had to be able to read anything at sight, of course, and to sing in any style. Or I guess frequently they invite different singers based on what they sound like, what they need for their commercials. But they would come in, and I mean, in the matter of 15 to 30 minutes, put down a jingle, and somebody told me how much they got paid at that time, the top singers. I don't know, it was something like $500,000 a year or something. And I just thought, oh my gosh, you know, I mean, it's terrible to hear me talking this way now, but I thought, gee, that sounds like a good living to me.
Was there a certain kind of jingle you could imagine yourself singing?
Well, there was one of my favorites that I heard while I was working, which is, I'll give a plug right now for Kalamazoo, Michigan. It was about Kalamazoo, and it said, "Yes, there really is a Kalamazoo, so much to offer you." I don't know, I really liked the tune, and I thought this would be really fun, you know. Somehow I got distracted. I don't know that I would never consider doing that, but I guess other things have caught my eye since.
Oh, well, something to fall back on.
Perhaps.
Dawn Upshaw talking with Terry Gross in 1994. Here's a selection from her new recording. Dawn Upshaw sings Rodgers and Hart.
Write a book about the way you walk and whisper and look. I could write a preface on how we met, so the world to tell them that I love you.
Dawn Upshaw with pianist Fred Hirsch from her new recording, Dawn Upshaw Sings Rodgers and Hart. This Monday on Fresh Air, a special concert with Dawn Upshaw. This is Fresh Air. When filmmaker Philip Haas read A.S. Byatt's 1990 novella Morpho Eugenia, he knew immediately that it had cinematic possibilities. Set in Victorian England, it's the story of William Adamson, a naturalist who has spent many years doing research on the Amazon. On his return to England, one of his sponsors, Harold Alabaster, an amateur insect collector, invites him to live on his estate. Adamson is immediately entranced by Alabaster's daughter, Eugenia, whom he marries. But all is not what it seems in the Alabaster family. There are dark secrets beneath the outward civility. Haas's film of Byatt's novel is called Angels and Insects, and it's now out on video. Here's a scene from the beginning of Angels and Insects when Adamson, played by Mark Rylance, has his first naive encounter with Eugenia Alabaster, played by Patsy Kensit, at a ball.
My father was so sorry to hear you had lost so much in the terrible shipwreck. For your sake, and for his own, he was eager to add to his collection.
Well, I did manage to save one or two of the rarest, most beautiful butterflies. I suppose there's a certain pathos in saving a dead butterfly. But one in particular is such a rarity. I say no more now, but I believe your father will be glad to have it. And you too. But it's to be a surprise, really.
I hate people who tell me I am to have a surprise and will not tell me what it is.
You don't like suspense?
No. No, I don't. I am afraid of surprises.
I must remember never to surprise you then.
What interested you about the story?
I was very much attracted to the visual possibilities in the story. The idea of comparing a Victorian house to an ant colony, and certain other visual things in the film or in the story were very attractive. The idea of our hero, William Adamson, wooing his bride by creating a cloud of butterflies to encircle her in the conservatory seemed to me that if we could pull it off in a film, would be a magical moment. Also, it had a very compelling storyline, and the denouement at the end seemed to me totally shocking. I mean, when I read it, I was felt like I'd been hit in the stomach, and I wanted to reproduce that in film. So it was really a combination of it being a visually exciting piece, a very dramatic one, and one that made me think about the story for a long time after I read it. And what I try and do in a film is to at once engage an audience and then hopefully let them not forget it.
I want to ask you about a couple of scenes where we see the naturalist William Adamson. He has married Eugenia Alabaster, lives at the Alabaster Estate, and there are several scenes where we see him walking down the hall, and coming towards him are a couple of female servants, a couple of maids, and as they pass, they turn themselves and face the wall. I didn't know if this was a common custom at that time or whether this was something that you invented, but it makes for an interesting, powerful interchange as these people pass in these darkened hallways.
I got the idea because in researching the period, I read that a particularly nasty lord fired any servant who dared to cross his path. So I felt that the servants in this house would have been terrified that if they had any contact with the gentry, you know, their position might be threatened or they would be, you know, dismissed. So although William isn't quite of the gentry, they view him as, you know, he's now married to, you know, to Eugenia. So they just would not want to make eye contact with him. Similarly, since we are making this analogy between the worker ants and the servants, right, you can never really tell what the face of an ant looks like. So I didn't want you to be able to see the servants' faces, with the exception of the servant, you know, Amy, who becomes important in the story.
So, and in a sense, it's true. Their faces are kind of covered, and we see them. They're small, and they kind of flitter by.
Right. And in fact, in casting the servants, we cast all local people. I wanted them to be really of the place, and we were very specific in our advertisements of saying, looking for small, dark people to play this, you know, these parts in a film.
What's the challenge of working with insects, specifically in this film, butterflies, moths, ants? As a film director, who's in charge? The animals or you?
No, I would say the animals definitely were in charge. There's an old adage, never work on a film with children or animals. And, you know, animals generally is referred to as sort of barnyard animals. I now have to extend that to never work with insects. It was extremely difficult. I mean, each species presented a different challenge, you know, from the butterflies to the moths to the ants. I mean, for example, with the ants, we have a number of scenes in which a colony of red slave-making ants attack a colony of your sort of normal black ants. Unfortunately, where we were shooting the film in Warwickshire in England, the red slave-making ants don't exist. So we actually had to transport a log from southern England full of a red slave-making colony up at the dead of night so that when they woke up in the morning, they wouldn't know they had moved. We had to position in the exact same position to the sun as they were in the south of England. And they quickly adapted to their new locale. But after a couple of days, a vicious woodpecker started attacking them, so they decamped. So we had to then try and gather up the ones that had decamped and then bring another log in. So that was just one challenge. With the butterflies, it became a question of how many butterflies would one have to release to create a cloud of butterflies. And then when we figured out that it would be in the thousands, to actually get, you know, 4,000 butterflies became an enormous task. We ended up renting them from the Stratford-upon-Avon butterfly farm.
How do you do that?
Well, you go and speak to the owner and say, look, we will rent them at 50 cents a butterfly and return them to you. And we found that the butterflies really flew well for only one launch. So it meant figuring out a system of transporting them the 45 miles from the butterfly farm to the estate, then releasing them, collecting them, and sending them back to Stratford so they could replenish themselves. And basically we had a whole kind of carpool system of always having, you know, several thousand butterflies at hand, and then recirculating them after they had rested and fed. With the moths, it just was very hard to get them to actually attack the actress. We finally sort of did it by a combination of positioning them, throwing them at her. But Patsy Kensett, who plays the actress at once sort of attracted to the butterflies and repelled by the moths, was a wonderful sport, particularly since she hated the moths. They're awful, the ones we use, these hawk moths. I mean, awful in the sense that they're rather menacing looking and sort of dropped on her unexpectedly and made terrible noises. So she didn't have a whole lot of acting that was necessary. I mean, she found it very repellent and showed that enormously and easily. And I think the scene, you know, works splendidly because of that.
Yeah, and what we see are the moths really climbing up her dress, and she's terrified, of course. In the scene where the butterflies are launched as a sort of a great seduction, what were the specifics of launching those butterflies? What specifically did you have to do to get them to do what you wanted on film?
Well, one, it needed to look like they were encircling her and not just being dumped on her. So it was a question of positioning them with relationship to the camera and to Patsy. And we launched them with 10 people with butterfly nets out of camera sight, releasing them in the directions that we determined would give a feeling of them flying around her in a way that was natural and not looking like we're just shooting butterflies out of a cannon.
And that then created the kind of swirly
yes.
look that we see. I'm interested, too, in how you approach the scenes where people were having sex. And I assume there are many traps that a filmmaker can fall into in trying to put sex on the scene. Going into them or even conceiving them, what were your thoughts?
Well, firstly, I wanted to make it visually interesting. That is not to feel like sexual scenes that one has seen before. I mean, generally, in a movie, you'll see, you know, a man and a woman in a shower, you know,
right.
And it looks like a sort of an ad for soap, you know, with a bit of sort of Playboy magazine thrown in. What we had going for us here is the sexuality was very much a part of the story, so the actors didn't feel exploited in any way, and you know, they all wanted it to feel true to the story. And although this is not a pornographic movie, you know, we wanted their response to feel like a response that, you know, a couple would have behind closed doors.
I noticed many of those scenes were filmed through a kind of gauzy curtain that hangs around Eugenia's bed.
Well, one of the things that we did I think it's in one scene in particular that you get this sort of shot through the gauze effect, and it's on their wedding night. One, the gauze gave it a kind of soft, romantic feel, and then it was punctuated with shots inside the gauze, which were much more graphic and harsh. And I wanted to play on that, these two things of of romance and softness coupled by, you know, sexual rigor. And one of the things that's surprising in the story is this virginal character played by Patsy Kensit. Eugenia seems to, you know, have an enormous appetite for sex. And that obviously becomes part of the story as the film progresses.
Her bedroom, too, looks like some kind of a lair. I mean, it's an interestingly...
Yes, it's a kind of spider's web, isn't it, really? You know, it's a film about entrapment, and the bedroom is a sort of metaphor for that. Also, you know, it's a film, you know, in which the sexuality is equally explicit with men and women. You know, you generally, you know, in films which are dealing with sex, you know, in a sophisticated, shall I say, artistic way, you know, the director has no problem with sort of revealing all of the woman, and the man is sort of, you know, viewed as a sort of just the, you know, upper torso. And in fact, you know, here, you know, everybody is shown with their trousers off, as it were.
Philip Haas's film Angels and Insects is now out on video. Coming up, Maureen Cargan on Shakespeare at the Movies. This is Fresh Air. In the movies these days, Jane Austen is being unceremoniously nudged aside by the Bard. Film versions of Romeo and Juliet, Twelfth Night, and Richard III are currently in the theaters, and Kenneth Branagh's four-hour movie of Hamlet is scheduled for release at Christmas time. Book critic Maureen Cargan considers whether all this cinematic sound and fury signifies nothing or something singular about Shakespeare.
If Shakespeare could have seen my fellow moviegoers at last Saturday's matinee of Romeo and Juliet, he would have been delightfully reminded of the groundlings, the peasants and prostitutes who stood through performances of his plays at the Globe Theater. Like the notoriously unruly groundlings, the teenaged girls who filled the movie theater chattered, ate, giggled, and cried their way through the entire show. Every time Romeo, pouty Leonardo DiCaprio, appeared on screen, they whispered to each other, "He's so cute!" And during the climactic double suicide scene, the actors' lines were all but drowned out by the noise of near-universal sniffling. I loved how those girls completely gave themselves over to the pathos of the play, and I wanted to share their emotions, but I couldn't. It's an age thing. As the distinguished literary critic Frank Kermode once said of Romeo and Juliet, youth in the play is a separate nation. To suit Shakespeare's tragedy about young lovers to a young audience, director Baz Luhrmann has given it a jittery postmodern look. I liked some of his witty updatings, like having the action take place in Verona Beach, Florida, but the actor's high schoolish delivery made me cringe. Here, for example, is a snippet where Romeo's men are discussing the challenge to his life issued by his rival, Tybalt.
Tybalt hath sent a letter to his father's house.
A challenge on my life.
Romeo will answer it?
Any man that can write may answer a letter.
Nay, he will answer the letter's master, how he dares being dared.
Well, alas, poor Romeo, he is already dead!
5 minutes into line readings like that, and I was longing for a snortful of that sleeping potion that temporarily put Juliet out of her misery. Romeo and Juliet, like the other two Shakespeare films out now, Twelfth Night and Looking for Richard, grapples with the familiar question of how to make the Bard relevant. Of course, Shakespeare wasn't always treated with such trepidation. In 19th century America, scenes from Shakespeare were performed in mining camps and on riverboats. His plays were considered popular entertainment. But with the cunning stealthiness of Lear's daughters, academics gradually laid claim to the kingdom of Shakespeare and convinced the public that they wouldn't properly understand his work without scholarly intervention. With his high-concept interpretation of Romeo and Juliet, Lerman bridges the distance between the bard and his teenaged audience. Twelfth Night takes a more traditional approach. Director Trevor Nunn only tinkers with that play to the extent of setting it in Victorian times. Otherwise, his British actors speak in regulation iambic pentameter. This Shakespeare film doesn't defer to the audience. The audience must rise to its challenges, which I happily did. And then there's my hands-down favorite, Al Pacino's Looking for Richard, a self-conscious movie about how Pacino and a bunch of New York actors struggle to understand Richard III. Pacino behaves like an obsessed hard-boiled detective, turning over textual clues, slowly repeating lines of dialogue, and dramatizing scenes in order to let the dead speak for themselves. Looking for Richard reminded me of one of the many reasons why Shakespeare is so amazing, because he's on to us. Every desire, every shameful variant of self-deceit is contained within his plays. Grappling with their difficulty, you have the sense that you're grappling with the messy, complex meaning of human identity. Those girls who watched Romeo and Juliet with me probably wouldn't put the play's attractions in those terms. But the movie version got to them, which is more than I can say about my own early encounters with Shakespeare. In college, I scrawled the question, "Why is Shakespeare so boring?" on the cover of Henry V. I keep that incriminating paperback to remind myself that the bard isn't sacred, and I always wasn't such a staunch admirer of his work. But one day, while I was reading A Midsummer Night's Dream, I yawned and inhaled some fairy dust. And the world hasn't looked the same since.
Maureen Cargan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Bob Purdick, Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, and Dan Laughlin. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Terry Gross returns on Monday. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Morrow, publishers of the new cookbook, Baking with Julia, Savor the Joys of Baking with America's Best Bakers, based on the PBS series hosted by Julia Child. This is NPR, National Public Radio.